added to the draft farm bill, and that's called the EATS Act, which is End Agricultural Trade Suppression, or the Save Our Bacon Act. These are sort of somewhat dramatic names, but essentially those provisions would remove the ability for any state to have its own legislation about agricultural production. And so as small farmers, we were vehemently opposing that. The reason is that different states having their own needs, representing their own constituents, that creates a more, a more vibrant market opportunity for smaller producers. And small producers are not able to compete in that type of a market because it's so large and homogenous that essentially we're really, it's really set up for the biggest players to come and be able to be competitive and for smaller players to be shut out. So that was the focus of our meetings and discussions. In a sense, we were working against all of the corporate lobbyists that were, believe it or not, actually saying that this legislation would, if it were to go through, would benefit small farmers. So we were essentially saying, no, we're the legitimate farmers and we don't want this.
Yeah. And Two Creek is a, I've been on the farm. It's an incredibly beautiful farm. It's 100 acres, regenerative organic farm in eastern Pennsylvania. You talked about specific pieces of the bill that, you know, you're pushing back on. I'd love to hear just other ways that the farm bill could impact your work, or specifically eastern PA farmers as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you think about it in the broadest sense, it's sort of this legislation will shape the future of our food system. And do we want a resilient local food system where small producers can function in the market, where we're able to compete and sell our products not only directly to consumer, but into local wholesale markets? Do we have those opportunities or not? Or do we just want to concentrate all of the production in industrialized farms in the Midwest, and ultimately small producers in areas like Northeast Pennsylvania would not be able to compete? So that's essentially what I was telling my representative, Representative Bresnahan, who's on the House Ag Committee,
right,
that, you know, basically, do you want to support me and the other local farmers that I'm representing? And I said, if, you know, with this legislation, if you don't support me, then who's the other farmer that you're listening to? Because I don't think there is another farmer that would agree that this specific legislation would help them. So I really tried to press on Bresnahan's obligation to represent the needs of farmers in his district in Northeast Pennsylvania. More broadly, the Farm Bill is supporting industrialized agriculture. The majority of the funding is going to offer price protection, insurance, and other support to large commodity producers of corn and soy. And that's where the majority of the dollars are going. So that creates kind of an unlevel playing field where essentially these aren't even foods, they're industrial feedstocks. That would lead to, you know, the ability to create corn-related products. A lot of the corn is going to ethanol anyway. You know, soy isolates, other types of soy products that might be used in industrial food, but people aren't eating this specific corn or soy. It's not food in that sense. So the federal government is supporting an industry that is mainly chemical companies and tractor companies and large industrial farms, allowing those businesses to create food that's really not good from a health perspective. And they're basically subsidizing that in a way that food is cheaper. But they're not supporting small farmers like my farm or my community of local farms. So, you know, in a sense, they're supporting, I think, the wrong side of this industry, and they're really not balancing that with support for small local farms that I think are critical not only for nutrition, but they're also critical for the environment, the local environment. They're also critical for having a local economy, because local farms, they circulate a lot of dollars locally. So if I had my wish, I would get the federal government out of all of this and say, hey, let's have a clear and an open market without the federal government supporting the big players and the industrial system and then offering us those support. That results in our food appearing to be comparably more expensive, although it's not. It's just we're not receiving the same degree of subsidies as the industrial food system is. I'd rather have the whole farm bill gone. But that I don't think that's politically viable. So if that's the case, then I'd rather also add some provisions that might be helpful to small farms like ours.
And, you know, Brent, as you're well aware, I mean, small farmers have really taken a hit this year with the massive USDA cuts that we saw, the delays, you know, even just notably the cancellation of the $1 billion program for schools and food banks to purchase from local farmers. I'm curious just how does the cancellation and cuts of these federal programs that really supported small farmers, how does that intersect at all with the Farm Bill?
Those are directly related. There was something called a continuing... I forget the exact term, but earlier in the year, I had been in D.C., I think it was in February, just as the Trump administration was proceeding with those budget cuts. So those were funds, it was a budget realignment, and those funds were removed from the Farm Bill budget. Mm-hmm. So it's the same pool of money that effectively had been removed. But the Farm Bill was not re-approved. It was just a process of removing funding from it. At this point, it's a different set of decisions because the bill would, in effect, be rewritten and reapproved.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's all the same thing.
Brent, what are the next steps here with the Farm Bill?
Well, it's really a question of sort of how it's prioritized in terms of the agenda in Congress, and obviously that's outside of our control entirely. But we did share our thoughts, and we have a variety of follow up. We write letters. You know, we'll continue to remain active, and as it continues to proceed, and if they get closer to actually moving forward with it, then we'll be back and we'll continue to share our voice. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. I think we were there at the right point, and as it does move forward, if it does, then we'll continue to engage.
And is there anything else that you want to lift up that maybe we haven't already discussed?
I guess it's important that everyone be aware that our federal policy primarily And the Farm Bill is shaping the future of our food system. And that is shaping whether or not small family farms can exist, can compete. And so it's very important to, as a citizen, remain aware and engaged in this topic, because it's so critical to what's happening in our local communities. And I think the awareness of that may not be high enough about how important this is relative to where we're able to buy food, the quality of that food, the nutrition available, environmental characteristics, and how it may or may not support vibrant local economies. There's a lot at stake with this.
Well, Brent, I really appreciate you talking through especially the ways that policy intersects with our local food ecosystems, where we can access our food, but also who we can buy our food from, is all tied to the Farm Bill and policy locally and at the federal level. So I really appreciate you hopping on today to chat through this. Been chatting with Brent Habig of Two Creek Farm in Lakewood, Pennsylvania. Brent, thank you so, so much for hopping on.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Moving right along, you know what time it is? This week's Star Talk Report with Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. Looming large in the southern sky in the evenings this week is the constellation Cetus. Cetus is the fourth largest constellation in the night sky and depicts a sea monster, or a whale. The constellation is one of the Mesopotamian constellations that was passed down to the Greeks and was included in Ptolemy's Almagest in the 2nd century. While Cetus is a rather large constellation, it is not that prominent in the sky and is difficult to find. The shape of the constellation resembles a whale with a large round head and an upturned tail. A star of note in Cetus is Mira, a red giant star near the end of its life. In 1596, Mira became the first variable star discovered. The star increases in brightness every 332 days. Currently, Mira is too faint to be seen with the unaided eye, and at its peak, it is a modestly bright second magnitude star. At its faintest, it is a 10th magnitude star, meaning it is almost 1,600 times brighter at its peak than at its faintest. Another interesting attribute of Mira is that it is a star with a tail. Material is blowing off Mira as it moves through our galaxy, leaving a tail visible in ultraviolet light that is 13 light years long. This week, Cetus will be visible in the southeastern sky starting around 9 p.m. and will crawl across the sky to the southwest, where it will set around 3 a.m. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks to Keith for this week's report from the stars. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, what's it taste like to blend local upstate New York apple cider vinegar and Italian balsamic? We'll be right back.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Morgan Outdoors, celebrating 20 years as a local source for hiking, snowshoeing, and discovering the great outdoors. On Main Street in Hurleyville, near the rail trail, morgan-outdoors.com.
This week on CatsCast, authors Bob Studing and Nina Shengold on the Ashokan Reservoir, then and now.
Now it would look probably like a lot of the rest of the country would have walls on it and parking lots.
But the beauty of the landscape combined with that kind of underpinning of migration and loss, it's just so palpable.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Farm and Country on Radio Catskill. From Montreal to Italy to here in upstate New York, vinegar is a key kitchen staple beloved by many, including myself. I love using vinegar to add some complexity and acidity in the meals that I cook. And the Center for Discovery, they recently hosted a special vinegar tasting for a day of collaboration, creativity, and tasting, where participants blended upstate New York apple cider vinegar with 16-year-aged traditional Italian balsamic. Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo sent us this audio postcard from the tasting.
The sharp, earthy scent of aged vinegar hits you the moment you step inside, lingers in the air, weaving through rows of wooden barrels and whiskey casks. Cool floor beneath your feet, the quiet murmur of voices, the soft creak of oak, all of it sets the stage for something remarkable happening here at the Center for Discovery in Hurleyville. This tucked away workshop called Acitia de Sole, the vinegar house of the sun, is part of the center's Thanksgiving farm, a place where craft and care ferment together. Today, a small group of chefs and staff gather to taste and help finalize the center's 16th special cuvée, a handcrafted vinegar that's been aging up to 16 years.
12, 13, a bit more complexity. So very interesting flavor profiles with a long finish. So, yeah, those are the two best. There's also
three we're skipping, four is
number
here.
Two is quite good too.
Okay. And is 13 the last one?
And 13 number nine is a bit less complex, but quite balanced and smooth. So, different profile, but still very good.
That's Federico Salavin, a visiting chef from New York City. He leans towards the bolder blends, vinegars that carry the echo of oak and thyme. The vinegar house uses the ancestral method, slowest form of fermentation. Each bat ferments for at least 9 months, then ages in a series of wood barrels, white oak and cherry chestnut, for a year or even more. Each wood adds its own character, and each barrel tells its own story.
You choose in the wine cellar the different barrels, and then you put it together, the master.
That's Chef Cesare Cecilia, the center's chief of the Department of Nourishment Arts, founded the Vinegar House. Cecilia's journey began in the family's tradition in Italy and passed through some of the New York's finest kitchens before leading him here in Sullivan County, where fine dining meets compassion.
That nobody else in the vinegar world was doing this, but we thought that only because we have this possibility, because the barrel, they are different. They are from a different distillery, from a whiskey in New York State, or from a different barrel producer in the New York State. So, plus we have the Italian side, the batteria, different wood, because what is in the whiskey and what is in the new barrel from New York State, they are all white oak. But we have the batteria, they are different wood from juniper, cherry, oak, chestnut. Each barrel you're going to taste, they give a different flavor.
He once told Radio Catskill that some people think that because someone can't express themselves, they don't have needs. But when you're careful, you see when someone is happy. And in this room, surrounded by barrels and laughter, you can see it. Here's Gabriella Scott, Vice President of Development at the Center for Discovery, and what she thinks about the tasting.
What are you tasting there?
So in the first sample, it was less acidic, but I definitely got notes of apple and not as much of the wood barrel. And then in sample number 5, as an alternative, that one was super acidic. And even the smell, as soon as I smelled it, I could tell there was more acid in it. But still, the notes of like the apples and the wood barrel come through. And then I have left to do sample 3 and 11. But overall, the samples have been a range of acidity. But you can tell that they're apple cider vinegar. And the taste of the barrels really comes through.
She prefers the smoother balanced notes, sweet and sharp in harmony. But this tasting is about more than acidity or aroma. It's about collaboration. Resident staff and culinary experts deciding together which blends will shape the final bottle. By the day's end, tasting notes are compared, the favorites are chosen, the winning blends, bright, woody, smooth, will become this year's special cuvée, and the bottles will be sold to support the center's programs, but what's inside represents something far deeper than vinegar. For the center, food is just not nourishment, it's therapy, education, and connection. At the Vinegar House, residents and students work side by side with trained staff, pressing apples from the center's own biodynamic orchards, tapping the maple syrup from its woodlands, and harvesting herbs from the healing garden. It's work that's purposeful, sensory, and deeply therapeutic. Here's Scott again during one of the tours of the center's Discoveries Farms.
So a lot of kids come to us for the first time, and they're maybe eating 2 or 3 foods. They'll have chicken tenders, they'll have hot dogs, very, very limited diets. And so our whole philosophy here is really to slowly start to incorporate food from the farm, really healthy, amazing ingredients that everyone's getting on a daily basis. And it happens over time. But as soon as that starts to happen, we see reduction of behaviors. We see increased, better sleep at night. And it's all due to the nutrition part of our model, which is called the Synergy 6.
That philosophy called Synergy 6 blends food, emotion, environment, and education into a holistic model of care. It's a way of living that treats nourishment as medicine. That sense of shared purpose runs through everything this Center for Discovery does. The center is the leader in caring for children and adults with complex medical and developmental disabilities. It combines education, clinical care, and sustainable farming to create a community where wellness and learning go hand in hand. Outside, the air smells faintly of apples and rain. Inside, the barrels rest again, patient and silent. Each one holds more than vinegar. It holds time. It holds care. It holds purpose. Because here at the Vinegar House of the Sun, patience is not just part of the process, it's the flavor. In Hurleyville, for Farming Country, I'm Patricio Roballo.
Thanks to Patricio for that report. Oh my goodness, I'm getting hungry. Just thinking about all the different tastings, I can like smell the deliciousness of the apple cider vinegar and the balsamic. Well, we're going to take one more short break, but when we come back, more from Patricio Roballo this hour. Environmental newsroom Delaware Currents has covered the Delaware River watershed for more than a decade, but the beloved publication is bidding farewell. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got 3 great new cookbooks we're in love with, from how to make your home cooking a little more Japanese, to super smart, quick home hacks, to the surprisingly delicious food of monasteries. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
For more than a decade, Delaware Currents has been a trusted, independent voice covering one of our region's most vital lifelines, the Delaware River and its watershed. Founded by journalist Meg McGuire, the online publication has shined a light on the people, the policies, and places that shape the river's future, from drinking water issues and dam management to environmental issues, to environmental justice, for example, and the communities that depend on this shared resource. But after 10 years of in-depth nonprofit journalism, Delaware Currents will shut down at the end of this year. Recently, Meg McGuire spoke with Patricio Roballo about how Delaware Currents really began and the story she's most proud of. And here is some of that conversation.
Well, if you might remember that I used to be the managing editor at the Times Herald Record in Middletown, New York, and like so many people that are involved in legacy newsrooms, I lost my job. I spent some time teaching, but I very much wanted to remain in journalism, feeling like especially environmental journalism was one of the places that they were really cutting reporters left, right, and center. So I thought I could be a freelance environmental journalist, and I reached out to several different news organizations up and down the Delaware, and no one was interested in buying freelance articles. And someone suggested that I reach out to the City University of New York's Graduate School in Journalism. They were running what they called a solopreneur graduate course, launching people into this web universe. And I joined a little trepidatiously because I certainly didn't want to set up a website. That seemed to be way far beyond my meager abilities. But that's exactly what happened. It was not sort of a full-time thing, but over the course of 6 months, I got lots of insight from lots of smart people. And eventually, as a result of that, set up Delaware Currents. And what I have said over and over again over these past 10 years, when I started Delaware Currents, I knew about writing and editing because that was my whole shtick. But there are two other, you know, legs to this stool, which is technology and fundraising. And technology has never been my strong suit, and Lord only knows, not fundraising either. But those are the crucial parts to sustaining a viable website. But undeterred, I did start Delaware Currents. Now it's 10 years ago this past July, August. And one of the things that was shocking to me was there was only one environmental reporter in the whole of the watershed. And that's a gentleman who's still working, Frank Coomer, at the Philadelphia Inquirer. But by the very nature of it being, even though it's a large paper and its reach is quite broad, it doesn't reach all the way up into the watershed, and it doesn't reach all the way down to the bay, and it only maybe touches the you know, some of the Jersey situation sort of towards the shore, but just really whatever's due east of Philly. And it just struck me that this is a watershed that's too important for too many people to not have its own dedicated coverage. And so that's what I started doing. Now, when I started, I had not ever been an environmental reporter. It was just, I was drawn to it because I felt it was such an important area. I also felt 10 years ago, I was of the opinion that although there were some people who didn't think that climate change was human caused, most people thought it was human caused. And the people that didn't, well, I don't necessarily have to talk to them about climate change. I can talk to them about water. I can talk about water quality and water supply. And it felt like to me that that would cut through everything. Everyone is interested in getting clean water for themselves and their family. And everyone was interested in preventing floods and droughts. So that was very much the scope of my thinking, is let's focus on the watershed. Let's focus on its works. And one of the things that's so fascinating for me, like I thought, okay, I can write stories about Delaware. There it is. It's a river. I had no idea how much management goes into that river, or our river, I should say. And so the last 10 years has been crash course in understanding the river and its watershed, its people, its industries, its problems, its promises. It's been just a fascinating ride.
You can hear the rest of the interview with Patricio and Meg on our website, wjffradio.org. I love reading Delaware Currents. That's really where I get my environmental news and environmental justice reporting on the watershed. I really have turned to this publication as an expert in this space. So I'm really sad to see it come to a close, but I'm excited for the next chapter for Meg and the publication. Well, before we sign off, I just wanted to share a big thank you to everyone who supported us during our fall fund drive. We actually reached our goal in record timing. Several Farming Country listeners on Saturday, when we usually air Farming Country, we had live musicians come in and do their thing. And it was so much fun. But several of you listeners called in and made a generous donation. Thank you so much. I always love reading the comments on why so many of you listen to us and continue to support us. So thank you, really. It really does take a village to keep this engine going. That's all for now. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Coming up at 11, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. October 25th is the last day to register to vote in New York State. Early voting begins October 25th and ends November 2nd. Find your early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. Election day is November 4th. New York polls are open on Election Day from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. This is Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.